Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey guys, I'm Nadia.
And I'm Shabazz. We're just popping up with some essential news.
The brand new series of Doctor Who has begun.
And that means the official Doctor Who podcast is here.
Whether you're a Whovian or a Newvian, you are so welcome. This is the place where we dissect every episode, explain all the Easter eggs, and bring you some exclusive content too.
Plus, we'll have fabulous special guests and Doctor Who mega fans.
So come and find us. It's the official Doctor Who podcast.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 25th of May, these are our main stories. The United Nations highest court has ruled that Israel must immediately halt its military offensive in Rafah. People have been fleeing a camp for displaced people in the Sudanese city of El Fasher as fighting between rival forces escalates. Three members of an American missionary group have been killed in Haiti. Also in this podcast.
Phil, there is a tiger in the bathroom!
With the rise of AI video generators, how much longer will real animal stars exist? There's been a stark message for Israel from the UN's top court, the ICJ. Halt all military operations in the city of Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Every day, the city, which is now filled with more than a million people who fled the conflict, is bombarded from the air, and small-scale Israeli incursions continue on the ground as well. So let's look in more detail at what this ruling from the International Court of Justice in The Hague means. It was delivered by the presiding judge, Nawaf Salam.
The court considers that, in conformity with its obligations under the Genocide Convention, Israel must immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah governorate which may inflict on the Palestinian group in Gaza conditions of life that could bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part.
Well, that call goes further than Washington has chosen to go. And following the ruling, the European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, said the bloc will have to make a choice between supporting Israel or international institutions and the rule of law. I heard more about the ICJ decision from our correspondent in The Hague, Anna Holligan.
What we heard there from the presiding judge, Nawaf Salam, that was alluding to something that constitutes genocide under international law, the physical destruction in whole or part of the Palestinian people. So beyond that order for Israel to immediately halt its offensive in Rafah, the judges ruled that Israel must allow unimpeded access to any UN-mandated bodies to investigate allegations of genocide and must also ensure the Rafah border crossing stays open so the urgently needed humanitarian aid and assistance can be provided at scale. And then Israel also has to report back on how it's implementing these orders within 1 month. It really matters because what the judges are saying essentially is Rafah needs to continue to exist without this military incursion if there is to be any hope of Palestinian life in Gaza after the conflict, because at the moment that's the centre of where the aid is being distributed from and where so many people are now, of course, displaced and seeking refuge. And this case was brought under the Genocide Convention. South Africa accused Israel of violating the Genocide Convention, violating Palestinians' right to exist, right to be protected by that convention, which was set up after the Holocaust, 1948, to give a legal foundation to the words never again. So this ruling really matters.
Anna, the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said that the decisions of the court are binding and he trusts that the parties will comply with the order from the court. One Gazan man in a camp for displaced people said, "We don't need a declaration, we need application." And that is the issue, isn't it? Israel has been told that it must do this, but who's going to force it to do it?
That's exactly the challenge. And this court can't force Israel, can't compel Israel to abide by these orders because it doesn't have any enforcement mechanism. It relies on states to comply or international pressure to be applied. We should also just mention at the end of the hearing, judges urged Hamas to release unconditionally all Israeli hostages still being held in Gaza, more than 100 people who were taken after the October 7th attacks. But the real focus now is what's happening in Rafah and whether or not Palestinians' right to protection under the Genocide Convention can be upheld.
Anna Holligan in The Hague there. Well, as we heard, the UN's top court has asked Israel to halt all military operations in the city of Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. This is because of the risk to civilians, they say. Well, Julian Marshall spoke to Boaz Bismuth, an MP for the Likud party, which is part of the Israeli governing coalition. So is the court ruling regarding Rafah such a difficult order to obey?
Yes, it is difficult because we're entitled, we're obliged to protect our nation, the Jewish state. And if the battalions, the last battalions of Hamas, and they're not so it's not the last, are still in Rafah, and if our hostages are still in Rafah, then we shall fight in Rafah. But according to international law, we shall respect international law. We shall respect humanitarian international law. We shall evacuate civilians as we do in order not to touch civilians because this is not our aim. But terrorists, we shall. And we shall look for them where they are in the Gaza Strip. Because nobody will do it otherwise. If we don't do it, nobody will do it for us. And by the way, only just to explain to you, why do I say such a thing? No, the president of the ICJ of the meeting was the Lebanese judge.
Yeah.
Lebanese judge. He doesn't, I mean, unbelievable, our Lebanese judge. I mean, you can...
He was the president. He's Lebanese, but it was a multinational panel.
But it doesn't shock you, sir. It doesn't shock you that in his parliament, you've got Hezbollah members, but that doesn't shock you whatsoever. You spoke about hostages, it's 125. Doesn't make you understand that you should maybe tell the numbers. Three, by the way, bodies were brought back today to Israel. Families are totally, I mean, in condition that you can't even believe. But the way you present it as if Israel is the aggressor, and my God, I mean, the other side are the oppressed. How can you do such a thing?
Okay.
So when I listen to your comment, no, let me finish.
Okay, Mr. Bismuth, we don't have a lot of time.
But I will tell you, unbelievable that ICC and ICJ, we don't talk about Hamas, we speak about Israel. 7th of October didn't occur 10 years ago or a century ago. It occurred 7 months ago. Women were raped. Now, 2 days ago, there are pictures of our soldiers, 19 years old, 18 years old, captured, bleeding by Hamas. But this doesn't shock you. You don't talk about it.
Okay.
There's no compassion. There's nothing. It's all about Hamas and Israel, the oppressor. But please ask your questions. No problems. Ask.
Okay, I can now ask questions. Questions.
Please.
Okay, it was Hamas that carried out those dreadful attacks in Israel last October. But Israel has decided to avenge itself, the Palestinian population of Gaza. You feel that there is a justification for doing that, but it seems that as if you're more and more out of step with international opinion, which sees the needless deaths of civilians as Israel pursues its aim. That is the equation here.
So first of all, when you speak of international opinion, when I hear the, let's take, for example, the ICC and the persecutor with this warrant against an Israeli prime minister, never, ever a leader of a democratic country should have faced such an event. I saw your prime minister, I saw the American president, that were not very much, how would I say, they didn't appreciate that decision. On the contrary, they attacked it. I mean, on the contrary, they slammed it. This is A. B, concerning the ICJ today, let me remind you again, Israel was aggressed. Now, one thing I have to assure all the people who are listening to us, we are fighting against terrorists, not against civilians. You speak about the Rafah now, because Rafah is concerned. I mean,
more than 35,000 people have been killed in Gaza since the beginning.
You know, sir, can you guarantee to me how many among them are civilians or terrorists? Can you guarantee to me how many were killed by Israel or by Hamas? Can you tell me? Do you know the numbers?
As Boaz Bismuth. For more on what impact the ICJ ruling will have on the situation in Gaza, our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams, who's in Jerusalem, has this assessment.
As the court's ruling was being read out at The Hague, columns of thick black smoke rose over Rafah following yet more airstrikes. No one should be under any illusion. Israel is not about to halt its attack on a city it describes as the last stronghold of Hamas. Hamas officials were quick to welcome the ruling, but said it didn't go far enough. Israel's assault on the northern refugee camp of Jabalia, a spokesman told the BBC, was no less bloody. The office of Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, called South Africa's accusations false, outrageous, and repulsive. It said Israel had not and would not carry out military activity in Rafah, which could lead to the destruction of the Palestinian civilian population in whole or in part. And it said it would continue to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza and act according to international law. But with 800,000 Palestinians forced to flee, aid in desperately short supply, and parts of the wider Rafah area already being reduced to rubble, the court was clearly not persuaded by Israel's arguments. For now, Mr. Netanyahu seems determined to press on. But the ICJ ruling is just the latest in a series of signs of Israel's increasing international isolation. The prospect of arrest warrants from the International Criminal Court against Mr. Netanyahu and his defence minister. The decision of three EU members to recognise the state of Palestine. Reports from Washington suggesting that the Biden administration is losing patience with what it sees as the lack of a long-term Israeli strategy. The International Court of Justice may be powerless to stop the war, but the political and diplomatic cost of Benjamin Netanyahu's relentless pursuit of what he calls total victory in Gaza is mounting by the day.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Now to some other news. Thousands of civilians are continuing to flee their homes in the Sudanese city of El Fasher in Darfur as fighting escalates between the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and the military. The UN has warned of a growing risk of genocide in Darfur. Will Ross reports.
Eyewitnesses say a large area of Abu Shok camp is now deserted after people living there fled the RSF attacks. Many of the thousands on the move are making their way to what they hope will be safer areas of El Fasher city. But the fighting has been intensifying and spreading. Non-Arab rebel groups that sided with the army have been targeting RSF positions. The Sudanese Air Force has carried out airstrikes, causing further mass displacement of civilians. Some are managing to make it out of the city, but the journeys are dangerous. And without a ceasefire, the situation will only deteriorate. There's a great risk of more civilians being targeted based on their ethnicity.
Will Ross. A US missionary couple have been killed in Haiti as widespread gang violence continues to plague the country. Natalie and David Lloyd, along with the Haitian Jude Montis, were shot when the missionary group's compound was ambushed by gunmen. The couple's deaths were confirmed on Facebook by Natalie's father, that's the Missouri State Senator Ben Baker. The White House said the killings reinforced the need for a swift deployment of a Kenyan-led multinational force in Haiti. Will Grant reports.
As details of the attack emerge, it appears the Missouri congressman's daughter and son-in-law, Natalie and Davy Lloyd, were ambushed as they left a church youth event in Port-au-Prince with their children. The couple were in the country working with a missionary group called Missions in Haiti, an organisation established by Mr. Lloyd's parents. In a statement, Congressman Baker said his heart was broken in 1,000 pieces. Please pray for my family, we desperately need the strength. And please pray for the Lloyd family as well, said the Republican lawmaker. In March, the US State Department issued an advisory to all US citizens against travel to Haiti, given the widespread gang violence in the country. As the security situation in Haiti steadily deteriorated, many US citizens in the country left either over the land border with the Dominican Republic or flew out before gangs forced the airport to close for several months. Since then, the nation has descended into near anarchy. Thousands of people have been killed in the streets as gangs strengthened their control of the capital city and forced out the prime minister. In recent days, the airport has been reopened. The first deployment of Kenyan police officers to lead an anti-gang security force has been delayed, but the Kenyan president, William Ruto, confirmed his country's commitment to the plan during a state visit to the White House earlier this week.
That was Will Grant. Next to the French capital, Paris, where a ceremony took place on Friday in the city to unveil the newly restored Iron Cross that sits on top of the city's famous Notre Dame Cathedral. It was the only thing to survive from the building's roof after the devastating fire in 2019. It's been reinstalled above the cathedral's choir section after being repaired by ironworkers from the Calvados region of France. Notre Dame has slowly been restored and rebuilt since the fire. Here's our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield.
The 12-metre-high cross had stood over the roof of the apse at the eastern end of the cathedral. By luck, it survived the fire by the simple expedient of crashing to the ground early in the course of that disastrous evening. It meant that though the artefact was shattered into pieces, those pieces could be retrieved and reassembled. Over the course of the last year and a half, that's what's been done at a specialist iron foundry in Normandy. And now, in an intricate operation, the cross has been returned to the roof in exactly the same place where it stood before. There was a short open-air ceremony to bless the cross, an opportunity for the presiding priest to recall that the cathedral is not just a museum whose reopening in December is so eagerly awaited, but also a place of worship.
Hugh Schofield in France. Still to come.
Can I get the double quarter pounder with cheese meal? I think I'm going to have to go supersize.
The documentary maker Morgan Spurlock, best known for his film Supersize Me, in which he once ate nothing but fast food for an entire month, has died aged 53.
Hey guys, I'm Nadia.
And I'm Shabazz. We're just popping up with some essential news.
The brand new series of Doctor Who has begun.
And that means the official Doctor Who podcast is here.
Whether you're a Whovian or a Newvian, you are so welcome. This is the place where we dissect every episode, explain all the Easter eggs, and bring you some exclusive content too.
Plus, we'll have fabulous special guests and Doctor Who mega fans.
So come and find us. It's the official Doctor Who podcast.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast. Civilians being targeted, tortured and used as human shields. Sexual violence against women and children. Just some of the latest reports coming out of Myanmar's Rakhine State, where the UN says 45,000 ethnic Rohingyas have been forced to escape fighting. They fled to the border with Bangladesh after a rebel group took over the town of Butidong from the army. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told me more.
A few days ago, the Arakan Army, that's a rebel group in the state of Rakhine in the west of Myanmar, took over the town of Butidong, right on the border with Bangladesh. They beat the army, who did control that particular town. But what's happened is that people living in the town, there were many, many thousands of Muslim Rohingya, and they've been displaced in the fighting. They've been forced towards the border with Bangladesh. And there are reports that the town, their homes, their businesses, their livelihoods, everything that they have has essentially been burnt to the ground. One person described the town as being reduced to ashes. And what's happened now is that the Human Rights Commissioner based in Geneva has just expressed his concern for these 45,000 Rohingya who, at the moment, are at great risk. This is what the Commissioner's spokeswoman, Elizabeth Throssell, had to say about it.
In this appalling situation, civilians are once more victimised, killed, their properties destroyed and looted, their demands for safety and security ignored, and they are again forced to flee their homes in a recurring nightmare of suffering.
Well, Mickey, as Elizabeth Throssell was saying there, this is part of a long history of Rohingyas having to flee situations like this, isn't it?
It certainly is, as you say, a desperate line of terrible things. Going back a decade or more, really, the Muslim Rohingyas in Myanmar have never been accepted as citizens. In fact, they don't have citizenship. And they first persecution, waves and waves of persecution. The last big one was in 2017 when hundreds of thousands of them fled across the border into Bangladesh. And many of them are still there living very desperate, squalid lives in refugee camps. Security is poor there.
And for the Rohingya, it's all made more difficult because at the moment, the broader picture is a fight against the military government for the control of the whole of Myanmar.
Yeah, this is just one rebel force, the Arakan Army, fighting the Burmese military in Rakhine State. But all across Myanmar, you have rebel groups fighting the military. And as well as these ethnic groups, there's also People's Defence Forces who have taken up arms against the military government. And over recent months, the fighting has really escalated across the whole of the country. This is just one bit of it.
Mickey Bristow. The Romanian authorities have arrested a man they suspect of spying for Russia. Romania has become a hub for Western military and humanitarian supplies being sent into Ukraine since the Russian invasion. Nick Thorpe reports.
News of the arrest was made public by the Romanian Directorate for Investigating Organised Crime. The 39-year-old, who's been named by Romanian media as Alexandru Piscan, stands accused of gathering information on military bases and on convoys taking military supplies to Ukraine and passing that material to Russian diplomats. In Bucharest, the Russian chargé d'affaires was summoned to the Romanian Foreign Ministry to be told that a Russian diplomat is to be expelled.
That was Nick Thorpe. Iranian state media say the country's army has found no signs of criminal activity in a helicopter crash that killed President Ebrahim Raisi on Sunday. Our regional Middle East editor, Mike Thompson, reports.
Soon after President Raisi's helicopter crashed on Sunday in a mountainous region of northwest Iran, rumours began circulating. Some accused the country's archenemy Israel of shooting the craft down. But a preliminary report by the Iranian army said no bullet holes had been found in the wreckage and there'd been no suspicious communications between the watchtower and the flight crew. The report concluded that the helicopter crashed after catching fire in an elevated area in foggy conditions. The late president was buried in his hometown of Mashhad on Thursday after several days of funeral ceremonies.
Mike Thompson. Now to the United States.
Tomorrow he'll play in a game that'll gross over $500 million.
But Emmett won't see a dime. And just like the other 12,000 draft-eligible players that don't make the NFL every year, his football days will be over.
Zero compensation, zero medical insurance for all the injuries he sustained.
My coach. That is part of the trailer of the 2021 film National Champions, which is about a college football player's strike in order to fight for fair compensation. While the film is fiction, it mirrors real life. Despite attracting huge audiences, college athletes in the US are not directly paid. But that could be about to change. The National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, which governs university sports in the US, has reached a deal that could lead to college athletes getting paid. Rahul Tandon spoke to George Zelks, a lawyer who has brought a case on behalf of a college student in Colorado. He told him how the current system works.
Traditionally, the only compensation they get is in the form of scholarships and some benefits. That started to change a couple of years ago. Compensation was available for name, image, and likeness issues.
So when we look at college sports, it's important to note here, isn't it, that whilst it is seen to be sports played by amateurs, there's actually a lot of revenue being generated when it comes to TV revenue. This is big business, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things that's interesting is when you talk to older people, their reaction is, well, why should athletes at a college where they're getting an education and they're getting scholarships receive additional compensation? Having been a former athlete in college myself, when you're playing in at the major school level, it's a full-time job. And in many ways, you're disadvantaged in terms of the opportunities that students that are not burdened with the commitments that you have to make as an athlete have in terms of their academic work, graduation opportunities afterwards, that sort of thing. So it's absolutely a full-time job, and they should be viewed as employees.
Give us an idea of what sort of revenues, and give us an idea of the level of interest there are in college sports.
It's not unusual for college football in the United States and college basketball, both men's and women's basketball, to garner the kind of television viewing that's greater than the professional sports are on occasion.
Can you tell us where we are in the legal process here? Because we have a number of college students who are saying, look, we're entitled to some of the revenue money. We've seen another significant development in the last few days. Where are we overall legally here?
What's triggered the current settlement proposal is the fact that in one of the what I refer to as the name, image, likeness cases, it's called the House case, that is scheduled to go to trial in January of next year. And the NCAA does not want to go to trial in front of a jury. The terms of the settlement and the proposal have not been filed with the court yet. What's available to the public is basically information that's been leaked to the media.
It looks, doesn't it? And we are still some way to go here, that there could be a settlement involving billions of dollars that could go to hundreds of college athletes. So are we looking at the end of amateurism in college sport?
I certainly believe if you view the concept of student employee athletes being compensated and being entitled to a percentage or portion of the revenue that they generate, as you know, I call them content creators, the same way people in the entertainment business are referred to. Yes, I think those days are over. Keep in mind that top level coaches in men's football are being compensated at the level of in excess of $10 million. And so when people pause and say, well, why should an athlete receive any money? You know, they're getting a scholarship. My reaction is, why should a college football coach receive $10 million or more?
Okay.
It just becomes a negotiation.
Well, it becomes a negotiation, but should they get less than what a professional gets in terms of that percentage of revenues? Because they are getting something else with it, which is a college education, which is pretty expensive in the U.S.
It's a fair question. It depends upon what kind of revenue they're generating for their employer. If you're talking about a professional athlete whose sport generates $1 million versus a college sport that generates billions of dollars, the idea that the college athlete, the content creator, should get more than the professional in that comparison, it shouldn't surprise anybody. It depends upon the value that you're bringing to the table.
Don't college athletes then, though, get the benefits when they become professional athletes? You know, if you are performing well at the college level, the contracts you're going to get afterwards are huge. So you are getting money, aren't you?
Rahul, here's the thing you have to keep in mind. A very tiny, tiny percentage of college athletes ever go forward at the professional level. The vast majority of them are looking for employment in regular markets the way you and I did after college.
That was the lawyer George Zelks. Well, staying in the US, the documentary maker Morgan Spurlock has died at the age of 53. He'd had cancer. He was best known for his film Super Size Me, in which he ate nothing but McDonald's for an entire month in order to measure the toll on his body. Will Vernon reports.
It was an experiment that sparked a nationwide debate in America and beyond about fast food culture and obesity. For 30 days in 2003, Morgan Spurlock ate three meals a day in McDonald's.
Hello,
yeah, could I get the double quarter pounder with cheese meal? I think I'm going to have to go supersize.
The smash hit documentary was nominated for an Oscar in 2005. Its enormous success was followed by a decision by McDonald's to stop offering so-called supersize portions, although the restaurant chain denied any link. Morgan Spurlock went on to produce many more documentaries in the years after, covering such controversial topics as gun control and the war in Afghanistan. Later, he admitted to alcoholism and sexual misconduct, effectively ending his career. In a statement announcing his death, the filmmaker's brother said the world had lost a true creative genius and that he was so proud to have worked with him.
Will Vernon. Will it take my job? That is the worry in the back of many people's minds when they think of artificial intelligence. In the world of entertainment, it's a particular concern because AI companies have started showing off what kind of videos can be generated by anyone with a few text commands. So no need perhaps for film crews. While actors, set decorators and directors have unions and lawyers representing their interests, Hollywood's animal stars could be the first casualty of AI video generators. Regan Morris reports from LA.
Phil, there is a tiger in the bathroom!
Ever since the dog Rin Tin Tin became an international film star after World War I, animals have been a part of Hollywood productions. But even the MGM lion is computer-generated now. And since artificial intelligence companies have started showing off what that technology is capable of, creating realistic-looking scenes, people, places, and animals with just a few text commands, many animal trainers who work on film sets think that their jobs are on the verge of extinction.
When I started back in 2001, that company that I worked for, they had 30 big cats. We had an African elephant. We had two bears. You know, like you could support that because there was work for those animals.
Greg Smith Aldridge was one of the tiger trainers on The Hangover and has worked as a Hollywood animal wrangler for more than 20 years.
I'm certainly worried about my future. I mean, like all the AI stuff that comes out now, the little Instagram posts and things that people send me, it used to be we're like, yeah, but they don't have the hair right. Yeah, look at his eyes looking. Oh, a dog would never do that. Now it's like, where do we get an application to Walmart?
We have, this is Clarence. He's a 100-year-old Galapagos tortoise.
Oh, wow.
The animal training and management course at Moorpark College, north of Los Angeles, is where many Hollywood animal wranglers learn their craft. The students run a teaching zoo, which includes an African lion, a few tigers, as well as Clarence the tortoise.
How much does he weigh?
About 500 pounds.
Gary Moy is a graduate of the college, and now he's back as a teacher after nearly 25 years working as a Hollywood animal trainer.
The reason why I worked in the film industry for so long was because that's who was hiring. There was a boom in the mid-90s.
How have you seen the industry change?
Industry is always evolving. You probably won't see exotics anymore. So anything that's not a dog or a cat or a horse, I see a lot of CG. And it's a shame there's a lot of good work there and good people. Frankly, there's things that we cannot do. So like if you look at the Planet of the Apes movies, the new ones, I can't train a silverback gorilla to ride a horse. And then there's like 100 of them. So like it looks real enough.
Legend says ape and human lived side by side.
Animal rights activists have fought for decades to get real animals off of film sets. So for many, AI video generators of realistic animals is welcome news. But what happens to these trained exotic animals now that Hollywood is done with them?
This is the monkey from Pirates of the Caribbean, and she does not like the monkey in my hands. This is Tara.
After 17 years as a Hollywood trainer, Stacey Gunderson now runs an animal sanctuary north of Los Angeles.
I did a movie called Hocus Pocus, where the cat talks. That was the very beginning of CGI. So the cat did everything, and then the computer graphic guys made the mouth work so that the cat talked.
Surely Hollywood must approach you. They know you're here.
They do.
And they know you've got these trained animals. Do you ever still get approached?
I do. Yeah, I do, and I turn them all down.
There's never an offer that good?
Well, the very first thing they want the animal to do is they want it to look right in the lens, and monkeys don't look in the lens. The monkey is here for the monkey, not for the movie.
I'm looking at how AI and CGI are getting so much more advanced.
Gift. It's a gift from heaven. Yeah, they can make a monkey look right in the camera. That's beautiful. I love it.
So you welcome that. You think that's good news?
For sure. It's good for monkeys.
Reagan Morris in Los Angeles. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lee Wilson. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.